Strange. Punks and Drunks and Flicks and Kicks. Written and read by Richard Strange. Episode 30. The job drought was finally broken at the end of October that year, first with a trickle of a Scandinavian TV commercial, and then with a comparative flood of a major Hollywood movie, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Originally called to a casting at Shepperton Studios to audition for the part of Little John, I took one look at the other hairy-ass man-mountains up for the part and knew it was a wasted journey. I'm tall, but puny. I was about to make my excuses and leave, but decided to stick around anyway. When I was eventually seen, they told me that, in fact, they'd already cast Nick Brimble as Little John, but offered me the part instead of the executioner. I was so hard up, I would have taken the part of the executioner's fourth assistant sister's dog. And I was delighted when they told me, but because the scene of the executions was one of the big set pieces of the film, I might be needed for a whole week. I accepted immediately, knowing that Hollywood money is always considerably better than any other sort of film work. We were delighted, and we felt as we drove back to London that this was the change in luck that we'd been waiting for. Contracts were quickly drawn up by Michelle, and on the 8th of November I started my week on the film. It was a typically wet, grey, cold English November day, and of course all my scenes that day were played outdoors in the main town square in a howling gale. It was my task to hang about half a dozen outlaws, hang one boy and chop the head off another. All in all, a good day's work, but that was before the minimum wage. The film itself is even more ludicrous than most period romps. Not content with just telling the Robin Hood story, this version had to introduce that little-known character from Robin Hood, Azim the Moor, and a witch, just in case there wasn't quite enough juice. In addition to a disastrously half-baked plot, the attention to historical detail was laughable even by Hollywood's high standards. Painted-faced Celts marauded their way through the action, having presumably got on the wrong chariot four centuries earlier and not been able to get off again. And Robin himself, that master archer, was reduced to the dastardly ruse of relying on gunpowder to achieve his ends, a mere 200 years before the scholars reckon it was introduced into Europe, no doubt by a distant descendant of Azim the Moor. And there, in the middle of it all, like a bland, blonde, beige blob, was Kevin Costner, an actor whose standout role for many, myself included, was as the corpse in The Big Chill. To call him wooden would be unfair to the mighty oak or the noble cedar. He'd put on a few pounds since Horse Feathers, Dances with Wolves, and spent the entire film fighting a losing battle with an elusive English accent. His friend, the noble savage Azim, was played by an embarrassed-looking Morgan Freeman, a truly impressive actor on his day. But this wasn't even his century. To his credit, he didn't even attempt an accent. As a piece of miscasting, it was as bad as Morgan Freeman in the monumentally awful Bonfire of the Vanities. For a great laugh, read The Devil's Candy, Julie Salomon's account of the making of that quintessential $50 million disaster movie. Things never went well on that picture from the start, but they got noticeably worse when Melanie Griffith turned up halfway through filming with a brand new set of breasts, which did not match her old ones. While the film was a turkey, filming it was a hoot. My 1 week turned into two, and then three, and then a fourth. This was not because I'm in the film for any length of time, but because someone forgot to write it before they started filming it. Not knowing whether they wanted an adventure pic or a light romantic comedy, they got neither. When Costner attempts gravitas, he is laughable. When he attempts comedy, sadly, he's not. When Sean Connery appears for a few fleeting, pointless minutes at the end for a fee rumoured to be £1 million for a day's work, one is past caring. His Richard the Lionheart was paid out of the scene's promotional budget rather than the production budget. The scene has no narrative point whatever. Its only function was to add a bankable name, Connery, to the credits and to the poster. In the end, the English actor Alan Rickman's caricature Sheriff of Nottingham turns the table on the Prince of Thieves by stealing all the best lines for himself and making off with the picture. Despite the extraordinary length that we'd gone to in the cutting room to cut Rickman's performance to the bone, poor Costner never had a chance against him for one simple reason. Kevin had never done panto. Also in the cast was the boy who would be Jack, Christian Slater. He was as nice a brat as I've ever worked with, and his boyish enthusiasm and recklessness came as a welcome relief on set after the uptight Costner. Kevin Reynolds, the director, was an old alumnus of Costner, whose career has not exactly flourished since Robin Hood. As the director of Costner's Waterworld, another of those films they don't talk about too much in Hollywood these days, out of respect for the dead, he didn't do himself or his boss any favours. He was a decent enough man to work for, though, polite, courteous, and willing to share a moment and a joke with his actors. I only had about three lines in the film, and in an attempt to elongate my screen time by a few precious seconds, I said to him, "These medieval executioners were a rum bunch, you know, Kev," hoping to impress him with my knowledge of arcane social history. "Most of them were misfits, outcasts, wackos. They were the only ones who'd do the job." "Oh, really? I didn't know that," he answered, intrigued. So I thought I might play the character with a stutter," I ventured. He looked at me, not altogether convinced, and then reluctantly said, "Yeah, okay, Richard, let's try it with a stutter." Unfortunately, I got rather carried away on the first take as I wrestled Christian to the chopping block, and with an axe poised, I told him, "There's always room for one more." At the end of the take, Reynolds shouted, "Cut!" At least it sounded like cut. And then, "Okay, we're going to do it again. Take two. This time without the stutter, Richard." Take two got the dribble instead. The famous dribble scene over Christian's lustrous hair. It was horrible. The public never got to enjoy the stuttering version. My death in that scene, felled by a flaming arrow, as my axe was about to sever Slater's head, got the biggest cheer of the whole film at the night of the premiere, and it was reprised a million times in the Bryan Adams video, Everything I Do, on MTV screens around the world. I still have the arrow somewhere, and I use it as a conversational gambit to bore young children when they come to visit and get fractures. They look at me with contempt through their 8-year-old eyes and say, "What a sad man you are." The last week of November 1990 was a particularly joyous week. Not only did my fourth cheque for wielding the axe in Robin Hood clear, but the British Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, was also given the chop by a disgruntled Conservative Party who rightly judged that she had become an electoral liability. Loved by the grassroots, the blue rinse ladies of the home counties, in whom her jingoism and her Euro-paranoia struck a sonorous note, her much-vaunted patriotism, comprised principally of selling off many of British nationalised industries and utilities, destroying the coal mining and shipbuilding industry, attempting to introduce the poll tax, doubling unemployment, and leading Britain into its biggest recession since the 1960s, effectively destroying whole communities, and then telling us that there was no such thing as community. And all the while her cabinet looked on, lining up lucrative directorships and consultancies for themselves for their old age pensions. Ineffectual, sycophantic, and corrupt. Or in the case of one or two, all three. To the surprise of many, not least to himself, her successor was not the perfidious, scheming, quaffed Michael Heseltine, but the grey man reckoned by the party to be a safe pair of hands, John Major, famously the only man to run away from the circus to join a bank. His term as Prime Minister effectively began in January and February 1991 with the Gulf War in Kuwait and Iraq. While it can be convincingly argued that the United Nations military response to Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait in August 1990 was a just and almost universally supported one, its avowed goal of liberating Kuwait masked its actual goal of liquidating Saddam. The United States, for all their military muscle and intelligence gathering capability, has a sorry record when it comes to liquidating its greatest hate figures, as Castro, Gaddafi, Idid, Arafat, Saddam and Bin Laden could all bear witness at that point, and it sometimes makes them very testy. The fact that Iraq was so effectively stitched up by the oil interests of Britain, France and the United States as long ago as the 1920s, and the weapons they used in the Gulf War were mainly supplied by the countries they were now fighting, that gave the war an added dimension. On the 3rd of March, the Iraqis accepted the terms of the UN ceasefire, their soldiers were allowed to scuttle back home, and President Bush and John Major brought their triumphant boys home. By the end of the war, the US had lost 148 men and women killed in action, compared with something in the region of 25,000 military and civilian dead suffered by Iraq. It was the first war in which the public back home, watching the war live or in recorded highlights form on CNN, like a sporting event, began to expect zero casualties from a foreign war, while at the same time expecting the total imposition of America's will. Thatcher's apotheosis, the Falklands War in 1981, had been the last war with real heroes who lost their lives, or large bloody chunks of them. By 1991, the public had lost their appetite for casualties. Body bags arriving home were no longer acceptable. We wanted risk-free war now. We knew all about smart bombs, but we still somehow felt cheated out of our heroes. As Saddam's crack battalion of Republican Guards turned their unwelcome attention to the Kurds and the Marsh Arabs in the northeast of Iraq, with all the anger of a bully with a bloody nose, the German and I were moving our German base from the affluent, comfortable and uninspiring town of Munich to the funkier, edgier Berlin. She'd got a job there at the cutting edge of the reunification process, and we moved into a hotel room at the Metropole in East Berlin and watched events unfurl. She walked each day to her office, first in Alexanderplatz and then in Leipziger Straße, and I walked the streets in the shattering icy winds that blow in from the Russian plains, wondering how to make it all work. To stay in Germany and work as an actor was out of the question, as my German was very rudimentary. My music career had sort of gone onto the back burner since falling out with Jim over his tale-telling, and I certainly had no intention of starting a club. As I walked through the East, watching history being made all around me, it occurred to me that there was a huge appetite for stories about the new Berlin in the press all around the world, and I should write about life there as a resident rather than just as a reporter. I didn't know many features editors on British newspapers, but I knew quite a few people who worked on the art side. So the first story I was actually able to place was a review of a big contemporary art exhibition in the Martin Gropius Bau called Metropolis, which had been curated by the British curator Norman Rosenthal. 1,500 words of elegant bluff, and I sold it to The Guardian. They only paid me £350, but seeing this article in print gave me as much a thrill as signing with Virgin, doing Batman, or getting the Hamlet job. In writing the piece, I'd consulted Louisa Buck, who by now was earning a living as a critic and as the arts correspondent for Radio 4's Kaleidoscope, on a few points of fact, but otherwise, it really was all my own work. In journalism and art criticism, as in everything else I've ever done, I'm an autodidact. With a good pair of eyes, a good pair of ears, and an inquisitive mind, there's not much that a man can't do. Writing about art is neither brain surgery nor rocket science. As Lou Reed so succinctly put it, opinions are like arseholes. Everybody's got one. On the strength of the Guardian piece, I was approached by Mike Von Joel, owner and editor of the art newspaper Artline, asking if they could run the piece as well for a fee. I cleared it with The Guardian, and a week or so after publication in Artline, I was in London. I stopped off in Soho one afternoon to visit Mike Von Joel at his office and to collect my cheque, and he said to me, "You know, we really like that piece, and if you're resident in Germany, would you like to become European editor of the newspaper?" I had visions of comfortable Chesterfields and three-hour-long lunches on expenses, and so, never one to look a gift horse in the mouth, I readily agreed. Mike issued me with an official press card, a document that, along with my passport and driving licence, has accompanied me on every trip I've ever made since. My first assignment in my exalted position as European editor was to travel back to Munich to review a show by one of my favourite contemporary artists, the German Anselm Kiefer. The show, Die Bücher von Anselm Kiefer, The Books of Anselm Kiefer, was almost unbearably sad. There was an overwhelming sense of human tragedy in those rooms, crammed as they were, of images of the absent, of loss, and of a country which no longer dared to allow itself to dream.